Hello everyone, welcome to Quantum Beats Podcast. I am Parham, and in this episode we have a very special guest, the founder of first commercial quantum computing company in the world, Jordi Rose. Jordi Rose founded D-Wave in 1999 in Canada, and he was the CEO and CTO of D-Wave for 15 years. After D-Wave, he starts two other companies on AI-powered robotics. The first one is called Kindred, which is a very successful AI-powered robotics company. And the one that he's currently working on is called Sanctuary AI, where he's the CEO and co-founder. Our discussion with Jordi Rose is published in two episodes. In this episode, we start from the very beginning, from the time that he was a PhD student in physics at the University of British Columbia, and he starts sharing the thought process and the challenges of D-Wave from the very beginning. He shares with us how they decided to go with the particular type of hardware that they are currently using, how they found the right employees to work on the project, and there are some very inspiring stories and tips for entrepreneurs and those who are planning to start their own projects. After that, we talk about different models of quantum computing. D-Wave is using a particular type of quantum computing called quantum annealing, and Jordi Rose explains how this model is different from the others and why they decided to go with it. This part is extremely unique and exciting, so I hope you don't miss that one. And by the end of the episode, he shares more details on the vision and the challenges of starting the first commercial quantum computing company of the world. For those of you who are more interested in the entrepreneurship part, he's sharing a unique document on how he raised around $250 million for his three startups. He has been kind enough to share that with us. So if you are interested to get access to that document, please follow us on social media at Quantum Beats Podcast or email us at quantumbeatspodcast@gmail.com. And finally, if you like this podcast, please tune in for the next one. The next one will be on AI robotics and quantum computing. Let's get started with your journey in quantum computing from the beginning. We know you started D-Wave back in 1999, right?
That's right.
So it's quite impressive. At that time, quantum computing was definitely not like how it is today. And, you know, it's interesting to know how your story got started.
Well, I came to UBC in 1994 to do a graduate degree in physics.
Right.
And I ended up in the condensed matter theory department at UBC. Not entirely by design, I have to say. So backing up a step, I did an engineering physics undergraduate degree at McMaster. And when I was done that, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. So I applied to graduate school in all sorts of different places, in all sorts of different fields. So I don't remember the full list, but it involved aerospace engineering, because at some point I thought it would be cool to try to build spaceships. I applied to graduate school in mathematics at Harvard, which is one of the most prestigious mathematics graduate programs in the world. I applied at Hawaii for observational astronomy because I thought it would be really cool to do cosmology / astronomy, and also Hawaii. and I applied to UBC for the physics program, like basically just generally theoretical physics. And through that process, the folks at UBC were treated me quite well during the admissions process, and I decided to come to UBC. But I still didn't really have an idea about what specifically I wanted to do. So over the first couple of years of your grad program at UBC anyway, you sort of learn the ropes and start doing some advanced stuff. And through that process, I met the folks in the kinetic matter theory department, including Ian Affleck and Philip Stamp, and a couple other folks. And I ended up having, it was sort of a mutual decision that Philip Stamp and I were going to work together in kinetic matter theory. So the topic that I worked on was, literally it was about a kind of material called a molecular magnet. So a molecular magnet's a very interesting material, which you can think of as a lattice of little magnets.
Okay.
And these magnets are very little, so little that when you cool this material past a certain point, these magnets start behaving quantum mechanically, and the bulk properties of the material change. So it's not just that just some tiny little thing changes; the entire behavior of a macroscopic chunk of this thing changes when you cool it past a certain point. So what we were studying was the quantitative mechanisms of how the transition between the classical world and the quantum world happen in this specific set of materials. So often when you first learn about quantum mechanics, you hear something like quantum mechanics is a set of rules that only applies under certain circumstances, or more specifically, its effects are only apparent under certain circumstances. So something has to be very cold and very isolated and so on. So that's true, but it begs the question about why. You know, what is it, what's happening in the deepest recesses of physics that makes that true? So in kinetic matter theory, you have this ability to create an Earth-like human-scale laboratory at which you can probe some of the deepest questions about the nature of reality. So a crystal of a material may seem a little boring and pedestrian, but certain kinds of materials are like windows into fundamental facts about the world. So these molecular magnets, for me, were a little bit like that, in which you could characterize all of the properties of the thing mathematically to some extent, and then you could use those properties to ask the question, why is this thing turning into a quantum magnet exactly at 380 millikelvin or whatever it was? There was some very sharp transition temperature under which it would change its properties. And so we looked at that question, and the not to get too esoteric, but in this particular material, the answer was nuclear spins. So in atoms, atoms have nuclei, and nuclei can also be like little magnets. And the magnetization of a nucleus is called its spin. And these little magnets, you can think of them as kind of like wrapping themselves around the central magnet in a way. So you can think of them as being in the lingo entangled with the central object that you care about, this little quantum magnet that's part of this material. And this kind of enveloping embrace of all of these multiplicity of nuclei, when you actually work the numbers and figure out quantitatively what you'd expect to happen, ended up creating this transition exactly at the right temperature. So it was one of those things where I think everybody who's done research, when you finally connect the dots between a thing that you were thinking and the actual mathematics or the numbers involved in finding out whether your thought is correct and they match, you have this like, aha, this right. is, I'm actually seeing something real about the way that the world works. So that was the origin of it, is in a deeply academic drive to understand some fundamental property of the world. Right. So from that,
So that was like your PhD, right? That was like,
yeah. So I, as everybody does, I think anyway, at UBC, I started in a master's degree, but then I kind of skipped over that and just went directly into a PhD. Yeah. So in my last year of my PhD, I took a course that was taught by Haig Ferris, who is kind of a legend in the local entrepreneurial community. And the premise of the course was it was bringing together people with degrees in science and engineering with people from the business community, both MBAs who were in school and also people who'd actually built businesses locally and how, you know, in an entrepreneurial context,
right.
Startups mostly. And so I was absolutely taken by this idea. And primarily it was because I saw it as a mechanism for funding the development of things that don't exist. So in the world around us is filled with marvels and wonders, but we've only scratched the surface of the sorts of things that are possible to build. So the question is, as a person who's interested in building things and understanding things, if you wanted to build something that didn't exist that you think should, how would you do it? And this was an answer. So all of a sudden, another missing piece of the puzzle for me slotted into place. A startup company can be thought of as a machine for the creation of something new. And what that something new is totally up to you. So you can build a machine to create a quantum computer, which is what D-Wave was. You can build a machine to create artificial general intelligence, which is what I'm working on now. You can build a machine to build a spaceship that brings people to Mars.
Right.
Or a machine to build electric cars, or a machine to build anything you can think of. So the freedom that this kind of organizational vehicle, it just kind of, there was like a Cambrian explosion of ideas in my mind when I went through that about what possibilities there existed to actually change the world through this type of thing. And when you're an academic or going through the academic system, especially as a graduate student, at least back when I did it, there was a real big railroading process happening. You weren't told or it wasn't made obvious that there was all sorts of different things that you could do with your life. You were going to be a professor. I mean, that's why you did a theoretical physics PhD, is that you were going to teach and do research. And that was the end of the story. And I think just to go off on a tangent here a little bit, the world has changed so dramatically with the advent of the internet. I just wanted to make clear that when I was going through graduate school, the internet was in its infancy. It wasn't at all like it is now. It's not like you could just go on the net and see, oh, look, Elon Musk is like starting a company and Manning, I could do that too. That wasn't like that at all.
Right.
Like you had your group of people that you did your research with, which were a bunch of humans that you stared in the face every day. And you had Usenet or something like it. Like those of you who are old enough remember Usenet. And that was basically it. Right. To the extent that you could use computers to help you do research, it was like tangential. I still went to the library and looked up every single physical book I needed when I needed a reference, even back then. And that was only, 25 years ago. It wasn't that long ago. So the world was a very different place. That course really opened my eyes to a new way of looking at the world. And from that course, D-Wave was born because I thought, let's build a machine to build a quantum computer. And that's how I always thought about D-Wave. D-Wave is just a machine. It was like any other machine that you'd build to build another machine. It was designed to build a quantum computer. That's what it was for. And all the decisions we made were in that light. And we went off and did the thing that we wanted to do. And it was very successful. I mean, it hasn't yet developed a kind of commercial success that I would like, but on the technological front, it fired on all cylinders and vastly outperformed everyone's expectations.
Yeah. So your view to entrepreneurship is kind of really unique here. And it kind of explains what you did after D-Wave as well. Like you started Kindred and Sanctuary as well after that. And it's very interesting how you see entrepreneurship, like, because there's always this marketing part and, financial part involved, but for you it's like can you rephrase the sentence you said? It's like a machine to help you to
So I think that the typical way of thinking about a business is a business is an entity that creates more capital than it consumes,
right?
So you generate profit. That's not at all the way I look at businesses. So there are businesses that are like that, but the businesses that I think create the most capital don't set out to do that. You know, it's not the reason that the people involved started the business. The usually very financially successful organizations, or successful organizations in general, have a mission. So if you think of any group of people that you would assign a label to as being like an organization, like SEAL Team 6 or, I don't know, the UFC or whatever, they're not agnostic to the type of business they do. They're designed to do a kind of business. And the reason that they do that is that there's a mission. There's some driving fundamental rallying force that brings everybody together and under a banner. So humans need to belong to something that's bigger than they are. You know, it's right. Just part of our makeup. And in the modern world, especially people who are heavily science driven, it's hard to go back to the standard sources of this kind of belonging. Like religion is not as big a deal as it used to be, you know, sort of 500 years ago. The kind of belonging that we used to have in communities is dissipating as people become more and more isolated. The belonging that you have to an organization that you work for is kind of taken over as the binding force of our, you know, this evolutionary need to belong to something. And so most companies, I don't think, take advantage of this nearly enough. They don't aim high enough. So for me, a business that is going to succeed at doing something world changing needs to have a mission that is world changing. So in the case of D-Wave, it was very simple. Building a quantum computer could be a very important part of the development of technology and human civilization, just right. Like building conventional computers was. Right. We don't know for sure, because you never know for sure when you build something new what it's going to be like in reality. But this is the bet we're making. And so D-Wave was a machine, just like an assembly machine or a car or whatever. It was a machine that was built specifically to build quantum computers. So when you think about an organization like a machine, it has parts. There are certain parts of the machine that are for assembling certain parts of the technology and certain parts that are otherwise. But it was never about building a money printing organization, because there are lots of ways to make money a lot easier than building a quantum computer.
Right.
In fact, building a quantum computer and turning it into a business is probably the last thing you do if you really wanted to be rich, because there's so many unknowns in terms of timing and the ultimate utility of these machines, and the competitor that you're staring down, which is the conventional exactly. silicon industry, is so powerful. It has a 60-year head start, give or take. In order to bind people together for such a long time for a project like that, there needs to be a level of commitment and zealotry that comes not from just being, a worker bee in a conventional company, but what you're trying to do is change the world. And so that's why, you know, but looking at the people who work there now, mm-hmm. there are lots of people working at D-Wave who've been there 20 years.
Right.
And D-Wave is still a startup. You know, in the business sense, it's not past that stage. So these are people who have been working at startup pace for 20 years, and anybody who's ever been in a startup might wonder how that's even possible. Like, that is an astronomical amount of dedication to be able to continue putting in the 16-hour days, day over day, week over week, year over year, and still be grinding.
Yeah, that's truly impressive. I remember I joined your talk in 2015. You used to come back to the same entrepreneurship at UBC, right? To give a talk.
Oh, I still do. Every year I come back and do that in January.
That was very interesting to see you coming back every year to the same program. And I remember you draw this graph that would show the population of Earth, how it changed after Industrial Revolution. And at that time you were starting Kindred, and you were telling like, that's what I'm after. Like, I want to make similar changes in the world. And I was very impressed, like, wow, this is very impressive. Well,
the wonderful thing about the state of the world now is that anyone can do this. So the tools that are necessary to literally fundamentally change civilization are available largely for free. You know, you can get an integrated development environment from PyCharm, it's free. You can get Python, it's free. You can get a C compiler, it's free. You can get a website for free. Like basically everything that you need in order to get going, you can do yourself. All you need is the drive and the desire to commit to the level of suffering that you will bear, and you can change the world. And everybody is like this. You know, it's not. I think the realization that you can affect change is this one of these light bulb moments that I think. If one thing that I can give to your readers from all of this is that, you know, that we make heroes out of people who do big things like Elon Musk and all this, but the reality is that the world can be changed by any one of you. You just have to commit to doing it. And the hardest part of all of this sort of thing is committing to it. You know, it's very easy to be lazy and to take the easy road when it's presented to you. But taking the easy road will never make you great. You need to take the hard road. And I think if one kind of mental imagery things that you can think of is that if every time you're confronted with a choice, you pick the one that that's the hardest, you'll be well on your way to being the greatest person that you can be. And this avoidance of suffering, I think, is one of the great tragedies of the modern world, is that we've been conditioned to believe that striving and suffering is wrong or bad and should be avoided in the favor of comfort. But that's never been my philosophy. I think that what you want to do is avoid comfort when you can, not in some kind of like pathological way, but comfort means the stasis. Comfort means things don't change. Comfort means someone else is changing the world and you don't get a say. So, do the things that are hard and embrace it. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with suffering and being and having a hard time of things. It's the fuel of change. And so that you can choose to embrace it. And that's what I and my team have tried to do. Everything we do is very hard. And it's not easy to do the sorts of things that we've tackled. But we believe that the juice is worth the squeeze, as one of my friends used to say.
That's very interesting to hear this from you, because, you know, it's quite impressive. You started D-Wave, but then you decided to work on the next one, Kindred, and then you started to work on the next one, Sanctuary. And, you know, when you look from outside, it's great that you're bringing this up, that it was not easy. You made the decision to do it, although it was not comfortable, right?
Yeah. And that's it's again, I wanted to just reinforce that there's greatness in everyone. You know, everyone has the capacity to endure the types of environments that would be put on you if you tried to do something big. Mm-hmm. And the there's kind of this homebrewed wisdom that when you feel like you can't do any more, you've only reached 30% of your capacity.
Right.
So if you're running and you feel like you can't take another step, you've only gone 30% as far as you can. And the reason is your mind is a very powerful blocker. Your mind is trying to protect you from hurting yourself. And so when you feel like enough is enough, that's a signal coming from your mind, and your mind is lazy and your mind is weak. And you have to master your mind by not listening. And so a lot of the stuff that you deal with in a startup isn't actually physical suffering. It's not like, you know, endurance running or right. Whatever. But it has the same kind of parallel, that it's always something, you know, something will come up that is a threat to the organization or something that you have to deal with. You have to be the team psychologist, for example. You know, people are always, there's a tendency that people have to complain a lot about everything, and you have to kind of deal with all of that. So that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. Potential customers will not be easy to negotiate with. You have to deal with that. And so all of these different kinds of things are all related to this essential idea that of overcoming. Nothing is going to be easy. If you expect things to be easy, you're going to be sadly disappointed.
Right. And, you know, I saw some interesting achievements other than your companies in your background. Like you used to do wrestling. I think you had the record for eating the most amount of yogurt in 1 minute. Is that right?
Yeah, I did.
Well, is it for the same spirit?
So the yogurt eating thing was a fun thing. So we used to do this thing at D-Wave where we would get together and talk about how to do better presentations, because giving presentations is an important skill, you know, just for life, communicating ideas, both internally and externally in an organization. So we would do this thing where we would have coaches come in and say, okay, here's what to do and what not to do and all that. And then at the end of it, we would do a presentation ourselves that was trying to like embody these kinds of ideas. And so the one that I was doing it was supposed to be about just a random subject. So I picked the Guinness Book of World Records because I thought it was an interesting thing. I didn't know much about it. So I did a bunch of research on it, and it was actually pretty fascinating. But the point of it all is it concluded with this event where I was going to try to break a world record. And I went down the list of all of the different world records, and many of them, of course, were totally ridiculous and I had no shot at. But there was this one that I flagged that I thought, I might be able to do that. And it was how much yogurt you could eat in a minute. So we set up the whole thing. We had judges, we had cameras, we had the whole thing is recorded. And in fact, I still have the recording somewhere. Oh. Someday I'm going to post it on YouTube because it's hilarious. But we set the whole thing up. I had the yogurt ready to go. The timer started, I started eating, and I beat the record. And now one of the sad parts of the story is that after I sent in my results, someone else had beaten the number that I had gotten. And so I never actually got the record, but for some brief shining moment, I had beaten the existing record, but it was And so a bunch of the people who were there said, like, you destroyed that. You could do way more. Why don't you break the next thing? And I was thinking, okay, this is going to turn into one of those things where some dude in Indiana or whatever, which was the guy who had the record, I don't even remember where he was from. This is going to become like a thing. And I don't want to like define the next few months of my life by trying to figure out how much yogurt I need. So I just gave up and I tapped out. And that was that.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, it shows that it's also important to be fast, not just, just complete it. So that's very interesting. I'm hearing really interesting stories here. But, you know, it's. I'm kind of curious to know more about what was happening in like early 2000, like end of 90s. Like, how was the field back then? I assume there was no such a thing as quantum computing discussions in public. I know like Richard Feynman had some papers at that time. There were some theory papers, maybe a couple of theory papers at that time. But how do you see the field back in, early 2000?
Well, there was a basic theoretical premise had been established by David Deutsch and Richard Feynman and a few other people, but it was kind of in the category of, huh, this is interesting. You know, that was kind of where it was at the time. And that's actually not quite fair. In the late 90s, there was a bunch of experimental groups working on trying to build systems that exhibited macroscopic quantum effects in the superconducting world. So the superconductors are interesting because you can build circuit elements out of them, like, you know, like rings and things of this sort, that exhibit quantum effects that are macroscopic in the sense that they're easily detectable by using conventional analog circuitry, So you can build fairly large things that are quantum mechanical,
right?
Because of the properties of superconductors. So in the late 90s, there was a bunch of work that was being done to try to observe first macroscopic quantum tunneling, which is, would be the tunneling from one macroscopic state to another. And a macroscopic state in the sense, so in a superconducting quantum interference device, which is a ring of metal interrupted by a junction, a weak link, the direction of current flow in this loop is quantized. So when you think about how much current can flow in the loop, it can't be just anything. It has to be certain certain specified amounts. And conceptually, you can think of this as being sort of similar to the way that on a string, the wave patterns that are static on a string are quantized. So you can have the flat string, and then you can have like one oscillatory mode, or you can have two, and so on. So in there's an analog to the amount of current that can flow on one of these loops. So what people were trying to do back then was to set up a system like this and observe the current, which is like 10 to the 17 Cooper pairs or something like this, like fairly large current. So we're talking like, I'm going to get my numbers wrong here, but I think it's like milliamps or microamps. It's some very big amount of current for a device like this, to see it tunneling between two different states. So current going one way around the loop, current going the other way around the loop, and observe it changing in a way that's classically impossible. So if this thing was a classical current flowing around the loop, you could not observe this effect. So there's two interesting quantum things going on here in the system back in the 90s. One is that the quantization of energy levels, like the amount of current, which is a really interesting macroscopic quantum effect. And then the second is observing tunneling between the two. But then the big thing that hit was the observation of coherent quantum tunneling between two states. So this macroscopic quantum coherence thing was happening just about the late 90s. And I believe the first people to see it was a group in New York led by a guy named Jim Lukens, I think. And the thing that was so amazing about this is that these two kind of like gigantic states of enormous numbers of electrons were actually coherently tunneling between the two, which means basically they're in a coherent superposition of the two states. And that was a revelation, because back in the early 90s, Anthony Leggett and some other folks were asking the question whether macroscopic quantum coherence was even possible in our universe. So this was an open question as to whether or not systems like this could exhibit this effect at all.
Right.
And there were arguments in both directions. And this experiment settled that yes, it is possible to have macroscopic quantum coherence in a system like this. So that was kind of the background of where D-Wave started, is that there were some experimental results that were very preliminary, showing it might be possible to build circuit elements that were quantum mechanical, like out of superconductors. And there was a bunch of theory saying hey, quantum mechanics is super hard to simulate for fundamental reasons. What if we turned that power on itself? What if we built a thing that was super hard to simulate and then used it to compute?
Right.
And so that we were way too early to be reasonable in terms of starting a company to try to build one of these machines. But those were kind of the threads that we pulled at. And we knew from the outset that it was likely going to be a superconducting based implementation, because back then it was really the only game in town in terms of scaling. At least, you know, in theory, there was no other way to think about any of these other things working. Although we did look at some of them. We looked at things like electrons on helium and some of these other ideas, but the superconducting ones, I think, were obviously the better ones. And off we went.
Okay, so that part was like a fast decision for you, because that was the existing platform, right? But
it wasn't a fast decision. I mean, it took about 5 years from the origin of the company to settling on a thing that we actually wanted to build.
Right.
So the first 5 years of the company were spent doing what I would think of as a technology agnostic set of interactions with academic groups, where we would go out to academic groups, primarily in Europe, staffed by ex-Russians, So there was a diaspora of Russian scientists out into Europe in, you know, after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And many of these folks ended up running labs in Europe. And one of my co-founders was a Ukrainian physicist named Alexander Zagoskin, who maintained fairly close relationships with a lot of these folks. So we went into these labs and said, hey, could you try this thing? And we would observe the result. And it wasn't just superconducting stuff. We did a lot of work across a whole bunch of different things like quantum optics and semiconductors and a bunch of other things. And that 5-year period, by the way, there are a lot of choices to be made in how you build a quantum computer. The actual hardware substrate is only one of them. Another very important one, which was, I'd say, formative in our path that we took, was the model of computation.
Exactly.
So in building computers, there are lots of different ways to build a machine that computes. There's not just one. So we struggled with the notion of the, what you could think of as the standard model of quantum computing, the gate or circuit model. Personally, I never felt that made any sense. And I've been on record as saying is I don't think it will ever work. And I'm still of that opinion, you know, 20 years later. 20 years of technological progress haven't changed my mind. I don't think that you can build gate model, at least superconducting quantum computers, because of fundamental physical reasons. I just don't think it's possible to scale them. But that's my own view. Maybe I'm wrong. But I've made that clear to everyone who's ever asked, you know, the sorts of things that IBM and Rigetti and the Google folks are trying to build are in my view, a colossal waste of time and money. So if you believe that, then the question
it's hard to scale, right? I think that's the challenge.
No, it's not hard to scale. It's impossible to scale.
Impossible
for fundamental physical reasons. Okay. I don't think that you can do it. You know, the amount of resources that are required in order to do even basic error correction because you need to in one of these systems. I don't want to get too technical about this, but the gate model is the product of the theorist's desires for what a quantum computer should look like. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. The gate model has a lot of properties that make it easy to analyze theoretically. If you're only doing pencil and paperwork, it is by far superior in terms of ability to parse it and understand it than some of the other models that have been proposed. And so you can prove things like runtime scaling and all sorts of other things. But the thing about it that's always been kind of, I don't know if an annoyance is the right word, but maybe a thing that I kind of like, you know, just scratch my chin about is that I'm a condensed matter theorist by background. So I studied real things in the real world. And that really has flavored the way that I think about things. So for me, I know that when you write down an equation on a piece of paper, that thing is an approximation of what's actually happening in real life. So it's not an actual Platonic truth about a complex system. In the language of condensed matter theory, usually what you write down is what's called a Hamiltonian. And a Hamiltonian is a descriptor of a quantum mechanical system. But Hamiltonians in materials are what are called low energy effective Hamiltonians. They're an approximation that's sort of right in a certain circumstance, and they are not actually literally correct. So a lot of the stuff that happens in the gate model is a idealized view of the world where people convince themselves that these effective low energy Hamiltonians are actually true facts about the world, and they're not. So if you add all the other junk in, a lot of the stuff that is believed about how you would make one of these things, just it vanishes into the ether. And one of the key things, this is business about errors. So if you include real errors that you can't avoid. I want to stress that these are things that you cannot avoid. They're basic fundamental properties of the way that materials work. You get terms that are significant enough to invoke the need to do quantum error correction. You can't get around it in the gate model. It's absolutely required if you're going to scale a thing. And then if you look at what these bounds imply about the amount of hardware you need to run even basic computations, you're all the way up in the, say, hundreds of millions of physical qubits.
Right.
So if you're going to build something with 100 million physical qubits, by the way, D-Wave has been at this for 20 odd years has by far, like we're not even talking in the ballpark, the most sophisticated superconducting fabrication that's ever existed on the face of the planet by like five orders of magnitude or something like this.
Like you have something like 5,000 qubits in your latest chip, right?
But forget about that number. Right. Okay. The number of Josephson junctions, right, these weak links between things, is about a million.
Okay.
So if you count the number of Josephson junctions you need in a 100 million qubit, fully error corrected gate model computer, the number is like, I can't even guess, but it's going to be 10 orders of magnitude more. Because the qubits aren't the only circuitry in the thing. You need all of this control circuitry to get information in and out. You need all the coupler circuitry. You need all of that stuff. And all of that stuff consumes Josephson junctions. And one of the interesting things about superconductors is that you can't reduce the line width of a superconducting wire past a certain point or it goes normal. So in a conventional CMOS process, I can make the transistors basically as small as I want. A superconducting wire is not like that. Once you shrink the wire past a certain point, the penetration depth is larger than the diameter of the wire and the wire goes normal. It's not a superconductor anymore. So if you ask the question, how big does a thing have to have 10 to the 13 or whatever it is, Josephson junctions in it, it's ridiculous. You can't build something like that. It's just not possible. Right. So how did this pathology arise? I'm going off on a tangent.
No, it's really good.
But I think that the reason is that the quantum computing emerged out of this mist of myth. You know, the people who were first having these ideas were people like Richard Feynman and David Deutsch, these massive intellects. And so there was this belief that the physicists who were working on it propagated that this was some big mystery, some arcane magic that only they had the right or the ability to understand. And so there was this idea that we had to listen to these people. Like if they said something, it had to be true. But the origins of this field are very deeply rooted in theoretical physics and theoretical computer science. These are not people who understand how the real world is built by their own admission. It's not what they do. Again, it's not a dig. I mean, you can't be an expert in everything. If you're an expert in the theory side of things, you're probably not an experimental physicist or something like this. So they were very strongly of the opinion that if you were to build a quantum computer, it had to look a certain way. And everybody around them kind of just said, okay, you're the experts. Let's try to build that thing. And this even extended to people who should have known better, like the body of experimental physicists in the world. And so the question is why? Why did this happen? And the reason, I think, is that the experimental physicists never really cared about building a computer. What they really cared about was the sort of thing that got me into physics, which is probing the properties of nature at a very fundamental level. And you don't need a computer to do that. You can do it with a single device. That's that single thing that Lukens built like back in the 90s that exhibited macroscopic quantum coherence. That thing opens up an entire playground of possibilities in terms of how you could explore deep facts about the way the world works. So if I'm an experimental physicist and I've got a bunch of theorists saying, okay, here's how you build a quantum computer, I'm totally fine with building one or two qubits or maybe 10 or maybe 20. Wouldn't it be cool to see how 20 of these things work together? And building 20 is no big deal. I mean, I think basically anybody with a bunch of money could build 20 qubits and make it work. But to build an actual computer is not the same thing. Building a computer requires people who have built computers. So if you're going to build something in the real world and you're not the person who does that thing every single day of their life for the last 20 years, step aside, because there's somebody out there who knows better than you. And when you ask people who have actually built computers if this sort of thing would be doable, they're like, obviously not. And the connection of these two worlds requires the pushing down of the ego, So a lot of people who are trying to do something big, they have this very specific view of the world that they need to push on everyone else. And sometimes that means you don't listen very carefully. So we tried to listen very carefully to people who'd actually built computers and made them work. And the proof is in the pudding. So the systems that D-Wave builds are usable by anybody. Everybody listening to this can go and sign on for an account and actually use a real machine that's at, you know, I don't even know what the temperature is now, but it's around 10 millikelvin. You're going to be able to send problems to that machine and get answers back today, right now. And you can do it for free for a while. Now, I mean, isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
that you can actually do something that's cold, like 100 times colder than interstellar space,
yeah,
to solve a problem from your living room. I mean, this blows my mind. So the progress that has been made by treating a quantum computer not as some mystical object of reverence, but as just a physical machine. It's just a computer. It's no different than any other computer. It has the same properties. You need to have a programming interface. You need to have a programming language. You need to have an ability to run computations. They need to be robust, et cetera, et cetera. Build the thing. And the conventional model of quantum computing has failed on every front. It's very interesting to step back and ask, for all of the time and the money that people have invested in this particular approach, what has been the result? And take out ego and your own personal beliefs from it. Just look at it objectively. Look at any metric you like and say, is it reasonable that an idea that could actually work would be this difficult to make work? You know, usually when, and it's, again, my personal experience is when you have an idea and you try to build it, good ideas get easier as they go along. Bad ideas get harder. So a bad idea will start multiplying all of the reasons it won't work, whereas a good idea will start dividing as it goes along. Good ideas become easier, not harder. And that's the reason that things like Moore's Law exist, is that the doubling of of something over some period of time is a reflection of the problem becoming easier as your understanding has grown. This sort of thing just hasn't happened in the gate model, whereas it has in the annealing versions, which are reality-based quantum computers. I would say they're grounded in real materials. And by the way, making a link to the beginning, the materials that I was studying, undergo a process called quantum annealing, where the energy of the system will decrease in a way that's entirely quantum mechanical. Through tunneling of a variety of different sorts. So the D-Wave architecture is basically a programmable reflection of the early materials that I worked at when I was on my PhD. Instead of having little magnets that are given to you by nature in this lattice of material, you build one. You build a lattice of magnets, and then you use those magnets to try to do computation. And, you know, is it the greatest thing ever that solves every problem in the history of humanity? No, but is that what you expected? Because if that's what you expected quantum computing to be, you've been sold a bill of goods. Quantum computers or any computer are just machines for answering questions. They're not magic. They're not going to change the world overnight. You know, the changing of the world is a process, not an event. And you know, I think I'm pretty proud of what D-Wave has been able to do in that vein.
Yeah, it has certainly been very impressive what D-Wave has been able to do. Also, I mean, if you look at how the field has changed since the D-Wave was started, right? It brought so much. I remember in one of your talks, you mentioned you wanted to bring quantum computing to the world, and like in a commercial way, like everybody can use. And you did that as you said in the cloud system of D-Wave in 2018. You announced Leap, and we encourage our listeners to search for D-Wave Leap, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they can get free access as well, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and they can get free access. There are some interesting examples on the website. They can try it by themselves, and they can really get connected to this -275 degree quantum computers in Vancouver, right? They're all in Vancouver.
So.
Yeah. You can get connected.
Not entirely sure anymore, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's certainly very interesting. But yeah, let's talk more about quantum annealing. So you try different kinds of hardware, and that's very interesting because we see a lot of quantum computing startups are still trying to explore, like, I don't know, ion trap, photonic-based quantum computers, Josephson junctions. And you did the experiments on different types of hardware at that time, and you were aware of a gate-based model, but you think, you know, it's impossible to scale them because, you know, once you reach such a large number of Josephson junctions, it's technically not possible to scale. And then you decided on quantum annealing. So can you explain a little bit more how you decided to go with quantum annealing? What was the thought process behind that? What was the early challenges?
Well, so I think that predating the decision to use that particular model of computation was a decision to try to actually build a quantum computer. So the first 5 years of D-Wave, we had not made that decision. The way that the business worked in those early days was we would contract a research lab to do an experiment or series of experiments, and then we would own all the intellectual property. So that meant both the knowledge about what was going on and also any patents that would come out of it. So this first 5 years, there was no intention or plan to actually construct a quantum computer at all. What we were doing was basically exploratory. And through that process, we probably became the single most rich repository of information about quantum computing in the world. So we had a very extensive network that was at its peak about 20 different research labs across the world, people who were at the forefront of research in quantum computing. At what was quantum computing in those days, which usually wasn't called quantum computing.
Right.
It's usually called something else, but they were all working on this sort of stuff. And we looked at everything. You know, it wasn't just hardware and qubits, and we looked at algorithms and different ideas people had for building computing models and so on. So at some point, it would have been around 2004, we made a decision that we weren't. So the kind of philosophy for why we did that in the early days is I had the naive view that at some point, one of the big companies like an IBM or somebody like that would start a Manhattan Project type thing to build a quantum computer. And I viewed that our collection of intellectual property, knowledge, and scientists would be valuable to such an effort, and they would either acquire it or work with us. So that was my naive view at the beginning, is that what we were really doing was doing a bunch of bushwhacking to prepare a bunch of ideas and technologies for somebody who would actually try to build a computer. And then we would partner with them and we would work on it together, us being a tiny little thing and they being a very big thing, and we would just help. But it turned out that at some point I realized that that was ridiculous, and that nobody was ever going to invest the capital required to try to build a quantum computer back in the early 2000s. It was just not going to happen. This was right in the middle of the boom and bust of the first internet wave. There was a lot of stuff going on where you could make a hideous amount of money doing stuff that basically was throwing up a web page. So nobody was going to invest in basic science or a thing like this. So I and our team got together and said, what are we going to do? This is not going to work. So the two options were, let's just stop this insanity now, go home and get real jobs. So that was option one. Or we could say, okay, well, IBM is not going to do it. Maybe we could do it. Why don't we try to build a quantum computer? And there was a lot of like looking around, like, really? We're allowed to do that? And so, yeah, so there was some soul searching. But then ultimately, we made the decision that we were going to try to build a quantum computer. So that was very exciting. But then the next step was, okay, now that we've made that decision, what are we actually going to try to build? And we had all of these different hardware platforms, all of these different algorithms, different potential use cases, different computing models, and they were all in front of us, and we kind of stared at them. And the question was, okay, if we're actually build something, which of these things are we going to pick? What like a la carte menu assembly of these things actually makes sense? And this was back when building more than, you know, 100 Josephson junctions on a chip wasn't doable by anybody in the world, basically. And all of the rest of this stuff was largely theoretical. So we said, okay, we have a lot of experience in condensed matter theory. We have a lot of experience in superconducting stuff because we'd at that time acquired the superconducting group from Northrop Grumman. We basically hired them all because it was from TRW event initially, and TRW was acquired by Northrop Grumman. And when Northrop Grumman acquired TRW, this program was cut. And at the time, they were the leading superconducting fabrication people in the world. So we hired all their team. So we had this capacity for superconducting stuff, connections in that world. We had the theory side from condensed matter. So I understood quantum annealing pretty well, but even back then. And we had this belief, maybe largely my belief, but I think it wasn't just me, that the gate model was a waste of time. It was just the wrong path to take. So we mixed and matched and came up with, well, why don't we try to build what was then called an adiabatic quantum computer. An adiabatic quantum computer is the limit of quantum annealing at zero temperature. So it's a theoretical limit. You can't actually achieve that in real life. There is no such thing as zero temperature, but you can get, you know, closer and closer as you cool down a material. So we decided to go down that route. And the reason was very simple. It was the only one of all of the things that we could make practical progress on from day one. And I've never regretted that decision. You know, you can look back on a lot of decisions that you made over your life and think, what would have happened if we'd done it differently, and sort of wonder wistfully about how things might be better. This is not one of those. That was absolutely the right decision, 100%. The history over the last 20 years has shown that. D-Wave has just continued to exponentially increase every metric on the chip, you know, the generation over generation. Inexorably marching. It's not quite where it needs to be yet, but that's just the nature of the beast, is that competing with silicon is really hard. You're not going to get some magic bullet that's going to beat, you know, the trillions of dollars that have flowed into the computing industry with, you know, one small effort. You know, it's not going to happen.
Right.
So the ratio of cash invested to capability between D-Wave and the entirety of the computing industry, the company's doing okay.
yeah, and we have seen the company like growing in terms of hardware, software, cloud. But how was that at the beginning? Like, how would you see your quantum computers growing at that time? Like, what was the vision at that time?
At the beginning, the metric was all about qubit count.
Okay.
At the beginning, all we were doing was saying, let's double the number of qubits on every chip every year. And that was
like
enough to drive. That was enough to drive most of the progress that we needed at that time, because mostly this whole exercise is bottlenecked by fab. You know, a long time ago, I was at a meeting of a bunch of quantum people. I think it was somewhere in Eastern Canada, and Dave Bacon was there, and it was a couple other people. And the question was asked of me, what is the thing that bottlenecks progress in quantum computing the most? And back then, the standard off-the-shelf answer was decoherence. So there are properties of qubits that they're not good enough yet, and you need to make the qubits better. But my answer was totally different. It's fabrication. You know, you need to be able to build the things that are in your head. And even something as kind of like physics-y as decoherence is ultimately a fabrication problem, because decoherence comes from a bunch of things, all of which are affected by your capacity to build a thing. So if you wanted to, say, remove nuclear spins, well, maybe if you could use an isotope of something that didn't have nuclear spins, or if you wanted to create materials that didn't have a boundary defects, you know, if one material is next to another and there's like defects along the edge, that's all fab. So my answer was very simple. You need to invest in fab. So this idea of doubling the number of qubits every year really was a shorthand for make fab better. And a lot of our capital went into the fab and still does. You know, fab is the number one cost element in any computing endeavor, including silicon. The thing that costs the most is building the chips. It just so happens that in silicon, which is actually a kind of a weird and dangerous thing, most of the fab is done in one place. Yeah. Every chip in the world factory. Think about that for a minute. The fab was the main thing, but there were other things like control circuitry. So as you grow the number of qubits on a chip or devices, whatever, you need to get information in and out. And the tactics you use to do that change as the scale grows. So at the beginning, you can just put like one wire per signal and just bind a wire, put a wire on a contact pad on the outside of a chip. And that wire just controls one thing. But as the number grows, there isn't enough geography to do that anymore. And you have to start putting control circuitry on the chip that will multiplex and do all sorts of interesting things. So we had to build on-chip memory. We had to build multiplexers. We had to build, all of the sorts of things that you need to do the control circuitry part as well. And all that was driven by doubling qubits every year. Now D-Wave doesn't use that as a metric anymore. Now they use different metrics that have to do more performance on problems, which is a different thing. So just doubling number of qubits every year doesn't really capture what you really want. What you want is something like compute power.
Right.
So their metrics now are about doubling things that have more to do with the advantage that you get as a user of the machine, and less just, you know, hardware stuff that might be an internal metric, but is only really important because it drives up the other things.
Yeah. We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Jordy Rose. We have another episode coming up with him on quantum computing, AI, and robotics. We also have other exciting episodes coming up with the experts in the field of quantum computing. So make sure you follow us on your favorite podcasting platform and get access to them. If you learned something from this episode, feel free to share it with your friends and colleagues. And finally, Jordy Rose shared us a document on the recipe of the fundraising of his startups. He raised $250 million with the same recipe. So make sure you follow us on social media at Quantum Meets Podcast to get access to the document as well. Thank you very much for listening, and see you in the next ones.